Welcome to the Archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In this program, we discuss the influence that the 1,000 largest corporations in the world have on American society and culture, and on worldwide society and culture. Our guest, Richard Grossman, is the director of the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. When I spoke with Richard Grossman by phone from his home near Provincetown, Massachusetts, when this program was originally broadcast in March of 1996, I began by asking him what, in his opinion, are these corporations doing that they should not do?
Well, I think they're performing the functions of governance. They are ruling like the kings of old. And if we are to take seriously the history, the ideals of this country, and take seriously the sort of what has the universe been exploding and creating all these galaxies and stars and life on this planet and its wonderful complexity and difficulties. You know, has this been happening that we turn over our authority over ourselves and our ability to shape our own communities and our cultures, to turn all this over to, you know, this relative handful of giant corporations like Nike Corporation or Weyerhaeuser Corporation? I mean, I think Thomas is, you know, have been pushing us to think in bigger terms. And our sense of what our work is about has been evolving in a, I think, for us anyway, in a fascinating way, in that we started off with the pamphlet published in 1993, Taking Care of Business, Citizenship, and the Charter of Incorporation. And it was really intriguing to discover that history and discover the role that charters played. And now, 3 years later, we see charters as a mechanism.
You're talking about corporate charters.
Corporate charters as a mechanism that people use to basically define the corporation along with the state corporation codes. Just to catch you, bring your listeners sort of up to speed where we're at. Most states still have the authority to, in fact, revoke the charters of corporations that have violated their duties and exceeded their authority. But we're really looking at, I mean, the fundamental question is, can we have a democracy if these giant corporations exercise so much political and economic power? And so the question really forces us to look at the nature of the large corporation.
Well, I think you're saying let's look at the economic and political power that the large corporations are exercising.
And particularly the political power, because I think people are sort of accustomed to sensing that corporations have economic power, that they control big markets and they can control, you know, they hire and they fire and stuff like that.
And they control what we buy and how and when we buy it.
But, you know, they do a lot more. They really control the culture. They control metaphor and language. They control our thoughts. But they also wield political power. They are making the decisions that human beings should be making about the nature of our communities, nature of our society. And, you know, why should we put ourselves in a subservient position to entities that, in reality, we create to help us do our work? I mean, that's the thing about these corporations. We're the sovereign people, or we're human beings, and we create like a fiction, a concoction, an entity under law in order to help get things done. Now,
well, Richard,
these entities have become overwhelming power, overwhelmingly powerful, and are in fact running us and running our societies. They own the government. They run the government. They run our elections.
Okay, let me come in here for a minute. You're giving a lot. You're beginning to get into the specifics of how they run the government and they run the elections. But I would like you to be even more specific as to how they run the government and how they control the elections, so that so that you can show how they are so disturbing to the American way of life that it has grown to be.
Well, in terms of elections, the sheer amount of money that they put in certainly shapes the public debate and shapes who can run for public office. With, you know, whether at the state level or local level or federal level, they're in there with the legislatures. In recent years, they're actually writing laws. They're educating judges. They take, you know, they take judges on junkets to the Bahamas to do seminars on law and economics. That's sort of the more obvious ways. In the more subtle ways, they really do shape the culture.
How?
Well, through the massive, big corporations spend about $100 billion a year in advertising. I mean, that's just, you know, what's really direct advertising, so that you have very intelligent, highly paid people giving us messages all the time about our role as consumers. I mean, can you imagine if $100 billion a year was spent to help encourage people to believe in themselves as citizens and talk to them about their rights and responsibilities as citizens instead of their obligations as consumers? Imagine how different people would think about you know, themselves in relation to their community, in relation to the broader body politic and the commons and everything like that.
Sure. Well, let's talk about that for a minute in terms of when we last saw that in America, and perhaps the time that comes to my mind are the Chautauquas of the 1880s.
Yes, from the Granger and Greenback populist days. I mean, you had meetings of thousands, 20,000 people. You had wagon trains miles long coming to the week long events where people would come and talk about the issues of their day. We don't have that very much.
And that was the time of no electronic media. As you and I are talking now from your home in Massachusetts and here in Ukiah,
yes.
This couldn't be done. It would take 6 months to get to the same place so we could talk face to face, and then there wouldn't be no electronic recording.
But there was still an incredible amount of information passed around. I mean, you think back even to the revolution, before the revolution, Thomas Paine's pamphlet, Common Sense, sold hundreds and hundreds of thousands of copies in the colonies, and you know, it was just a printed pamphlet, and there was, you know, no major advertising, and there wasn't an edition printed in every colony. I think, you know, I don't want to glorify the past of America. We've had some horrendous eras and horrendous things happening, but I think there was a time when most people, or at least many people, took their role as a citizen more seriously, or took their role as a non-citizen. I mean, there were an awful lot of people who weren't citizens who had to struggle and learn about this stuff in order to, and fight their way into becoming you know, people before the law. And I think in recent years there's still lots of people. I mean the major media don't have a clue, I think, as to how many folks are organized in their communities and meet and talk and are struggling against one injustice or another. And frankly, those are the folks that we've been going to. Our strategy has not been to try to penetrate the national press and persuade them of the validity of the things we're talking about. You know, we're reaching out to the people who are basically, you know, in their hearts understand that there's something very wrong. When they and their communities have very little real authority over shaping their communities, and that the entities that are making the key decisions, dealing with investment, dealing with what products are made and how they're made, dealing with work, you know, basically dictating the kind of work we have to do, are absentee large entities called corporations, whether they're located in the U.S. or from some other country.
And you have some ideas or some suggestions as to how the corporate entity can be penetrated or pierced so that local people on a local level can have more control over their lives?
Well, I think I would frame it a little differently. I would say that people need to figure out whether we want these giant entities in the first place, and if, you know, and to decide, you know, what kind of institutions of enterprise that we want. We need, you know, I think one thing's happening is that folks are making a distinction between doing business and the giant corporation. You know, we're told all the time or lectured all the time that without these, you know, without the giant corporations, we'll be freezing, starving, homeless in the dark. But there's an awful lot of other ways to conduct business, you know, without being a $100 billion corporation. So the question is, who's in charge? You know, are we, you know, is the language of the American, the ideals of the American Revolution, and the ideals expressed in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, are they merely cliches that we're a self-governing people? Or is it real? And, you know, people only have the rights that they're able to take.
And that they're able to recognize they have.
Well, but to recognize it and then to make sure that they're organized enough and educated enough and smart enough
to act on them.
To assert those rights, right.
That's right.
So we can define, you know, we can define the corporation or any other institution of enterprise any way that we want. You know, there's a history of even though the Supreme Court over the last 120 years has played an extraordinary role in giving corporations, you know, tremendous powers, giving them property rights and giving them civil and political liberties exceeding that of human beings, there's been a history of dissent on the Supreme Court where justices have been very clear, as legal scholars have and as a lot of citizens have, that the corporation is a subordinate entity. It is a creation of the state, and therefore it is subject to the will of the people. And, you know, you have cases of revocations of corporate charters at the highest state court levels, where the judges say, I'll cite one case in 1890 in New York, the North River Sugar Company, whose charter was revoked. In the unanimous decision of the New York Court of Appeals, there's a line that says, the life of the corporation is less than that of the humblest citizen. I mean, that was once the way both the law and the culture understood the legal relationship between us as the sovereign people and this subordinate entity called the corporation. So the issue today is not trying, you know, the way we see it, that it doesn't make any sense. You know, free people do not negotiate with a subordinate entity. We don't give them more incentives so they do less harm. You know, we don't try to just correct their excesses. We're supposed to define them. We're supposed to say, you know, if you and your fellow investors want to come together and form a corporation, it has to be by our criteria.
By ours, you mean the states?
The states. Well, the people. The people, you know, the people are supposed to be sovereign in our states, and we instruct our legislators what to do. You know, but unfortunately, the corporations today have dominated the state legislatures to a great degree. So we, you know, there's no simple, easy answer. We can't just assert this. We have to mobilize in order that the legislatures do what we want rather than what the corporations want.
For purposes of our discussion now, I'd like to characterize how I see a corporation. And that, to me, is a business organization that allows two or more people, actually one person, but generally multiple people, to get together and take the finest and the most quality skills, the most professional skills, and the skills to earn money of each of the individual people and combine them together to create a new fictitious corporation, the XYZ Corporation, for example, that would have someone skilled in marketing and someone skilled in psychology and someone skilled in manufacturing the gizmos that they make, and then they sell them.
Well, that the XYZ Corporation should not play a role in the politics of this nation. It should not write the laws or influence the laws. It should not influence the political campaigns, you know, what issues are debated and discussed. It should not have a role in educating our young people or educating anybody. I mean, if people want to form a corporation or any business entity to conduct some business, you know, it should be limited to that. And the problem is that these entities have taken on enormous political powers, and they are functioning, as I said before, they're functioning as the governing body. They govern. They make the real decisions here.
Richard, I want to ask you where you draw the line at political power, where it begins and where it ends. But first, I want to tell our listeners that my guest this week is Richard Grossman, the director of the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're listening to Radio Curious. My name is Barry Vogel. Richard, where do you draw that line?
Well, I'm not sure I can tell you where to draw the line, but I'll tell you some of the realms in which corporations should be prohibited from participating.
Go for it.
And corporations should have no role in elections. Absolutely none. They should not, you know, it's not just a question of limiting the amount of money they can contribute.
But let's hold that for a minute. Can you give us some examples of where corporations are participating in elections now in this presidential election season where they're going too far?
It's not a question of going too far. Any participation by a corporate, any money that they're giving, either directly to candidates or to think tanks in order to produce position papers, framing debate, the advertising that they give to the, well, first of all, they are the newspapers and they are the television corporations and they are the radio corporations and all of that. So already they have a stake. You know, when the New York Times Corporation runs an editorial, you know, talking about corporations, there should be a disclaimer that says, you know, just so everybody knows, we also are a big corporation and we have a stake in this. So it's how they're framing the issues and shaping the discussions around the and covering the candidates. That's one very very clear thing.
Another?
Lobbying at the local, state, and federal levels. Paying a corporation, this entity, this fictitious entity, hires, you know, on the national level, hundreds and hundreds of lobbyists, thousands of lobbyists, who, in this Congress anyway, have been actually writing the bills and providing information to Congress people. They set up all these corporate front groups, like the Front Timber Group and the Chemical Manufacturers Association and the American Bankers Association. Those are all corporations funded by the corporations, and they pour out an enormous amount of material that educate, and they do seminars for journalists and seminars for universities and for politicians. I mean, they are the ones with that money and those resources that are driving the public debate on public issues. I could say the same about the courts, as I mentioned before. Through all kinds of foundations and front corporations, they've done an incredible job in the law schools and with state and federal judges holding seminars all over the place, defining the issues, you know, giving them their sets of their resources, their studies, their documents, their books that they funded, pushing, you know, their kind of junk, frankly.
And your position is that they're able to do this because they have the economic advantage.
Absolutely.
And you have an alternative proposal as to a way of creating more neutral, more unbiased, if you will, information that provides for the public good and the public education for our current America.
There's two things. One is that we limit, as in the past, you limit the capitalization and the property holdings of giant corporations. You just limit it so they're not going to be that. Secondly, you forbid their participation in the basic mechanisms of a free people, of a democracy, in elections, lawmaking, judicial proceedings, and education.
Mm-hmm.
Don't allow them to give money for their chairs at universities. You don't allow them to hire professors to do their research. You don't allow them to contribute to campaigns. You don't allow the mobile corporation to advertise on anything but the price of their gas.
Mm-hmm. You know, what's interesting that comes to mind here in California, if an individual, you or I or anyone else, were to buy some real property, the property tax that we pay is 1% of the purchase price. Whereas if a corporation changes all of its shareholders, they're still paying the property tax of the purchase price back long ago, going back to 1976 when there was the last property tax adjustment. There's no change in that property tax based on the change of the corporate shareholding ownership.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you could probably find parallels in almost every realm where the being a corporation and being a large corporation gets, you know, it means that entity has more rights and privileges and immunities than an individual flesh and blood human being.
Richard, we're talking about some pretty lofty ideas here.
I think they're logical. I think they're lofty. Maybe people consider them lofty because we don't talk about them enough.
Well, also because they're out of reach. They don't particularly affect the average individual in our day-to-day life. And I'd like you to explain how they do reach the average individual.
Well, I think...
I say they don't, and I want to correct myself. I think that they do, but most people don't realize that that's happening.
Well, it's often said that fish discover water last. We live buried in the midst of a very powerful corporate culture. And I think if people start paying attention to the messages they're getting, whether on the TV or in the newspapers or, you know, from our politicians and our leaders, it really is, just to pick one thing out, that our role is essentially limited to being consumers. That if we're not consuming, somehow the country isn't functioning well, and that's what we do best. And I think, you know, if large numbers of people were really to invigorate their sense of citizenship and what that means, and their roles in their communities and their rights to help shape the future, people would find they immediately come into conflict with the dominant institutions in their communities, which generally will be, you know, for-profit large corporations and all the other entities through which they do their work, foundations, local nonprofit groups, local politicians, and all of that. That if people, you know, if there's something happening in a community that folks find inappropriate, and they start organizing to find out what's going on and then to try to stop it, you know, say a new power plant or a toxic dump or a new factory or any kind of huge capital expenditure that's going to make a major change in their community, and they start to resist it, they will immediately discover that there's an enormous amount of power and wealth arrayed against them, not just from in their community, but from all over the rest of the country and sometimes the rest of the world, that is employed initially to make light of their complaint, to start marginalizing them, and then to bring in their lawyers and their PR people and all of that. So I think if any of the listeners have any doubt that we live in a corporate culture and in a country where large corporations exercise enormous power, try to do something that's antagonistic to the wishes and goals of the corporate leaders in your community, and see how quickly everything comes down on you. I think you live in a county where most people have experienced that in one way or the other.
Yeah, that's quite true. I want to go across the political spectrum here for a minute. On the Insight section of the Maine Telegram, that's a statewide newspaper in Maine, on Sunday, February 4th of 1996, you quoted Chief Justice William Rehnquist of the United States. He's the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. In a 1986 case about expanding corporations' rights to interfere in elections. And I'd like you to explain that quote, because I think that we have a very conservative leader here supporting some of the things you just said.
Well, I believe, I don't have it in front of me, but I believe it's he's saying the corporation is the creation of the state.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
And he has, you know, the Chief Justice has his history correct. Corporation is a creation of the state, which means it's a subordinate entity. And I think that honest conservatives, and I mean, I'm meeting plenty of people who call themselves conservatives, who call themselves libertarian, who take that, who know that history and take that position. In fact, we've been organizing meetings around the country that we call Rethinking the Corporation, Rethinking Democracy meetings. And among the people coming to these are people who define themselves as conservatives or libertarians, as well as, you know, labor people and environmentalist people more on the left side. So I think it's an important, because this was the nature of the corporation historically in this country was as a subordinate entity, and that any decent lawyer or legal scholar that knows his or her history knows that, and knows that the record of that is overwhelming, and has something of a conscience, will understand that something very much is wrong here. And Rehnquist was dissenting in that decision. There's been a series of decisions through the 80s creating this what they call corporate free speech or commercial free speech, which is because the corporations are persons under the 14th Amendment, which came from a Supreme Court decision in the 1880s, they are now considered to have First Amendment rights, which is the justification, the legal rationalization for them participating in elections and participating in legislation and being able to lobby. In fact, the majority position in those cases is that the body politic is better off to benefit, because we'd be benefiting from the voice of these corporations, as if they're one more Joe, mm-hmm. Jane in the community, helping to enrich community discussion. It's a fraud, and somebody like Rehnquist, God knows I don't agree with most of the things that he does, but in this case, we agree very much.
Well, Richard, what is your brief experience in your life that led you to take on this this project?
Well,
briefly, I realize it's not a brief experience.
But looking back, it's been very logical that I've been involved in a number of issues and struggles going back 25, 30 years, and most of them seem to, lead to the doors of a boardroom or a state or federal, a corporate boardroom or a state or federal regulatory agency, which is more and more, I understand, is serving as a barrier between us and corporations. And about 6 or 7 years ago, I started to wonder, well, what is this corporate? What is a corporation? Where did it come from? What's its history? And that's, for me, a very logical outgrowth of the years that came before, and it's been a very exciting time for me to. I spent a couple of years basically reading, mm-hmm. searching this, and I still find reading old law review articles and old books quite exciting.
Mm-hmm. Well, Richard, we're coming to the close of our program, and I'd like to ask you the question that I ask all my guests at this time, and that is, could you please tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Well, there's a couple of books by a gentleman named Alexander Meeklejohn, who was fired as the president of Amherst College in 1902. Who was a philosopher, and the field that he focused on was American legal history and the Constitution, and particularly the Bill of Rights. And reading the stuff that he was passionate about the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment, but he had an analysis that was a little bit different from mainstream. And so I would encourage people to go and find books by Alexander, anything he wrote about American legal history and philosophy, looking at law as a philosopher. He wasn't a lawyer, he was a philosopher. I think some of your listeners might find quite fascinating.
Well, Richard Grossman, thank you very much for joining us here on Radio Curious.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Richard Grossman is the director of the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He recommends any book written by Alexander Meeklejohn. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.